Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The River. This is Tom Fuller coming to you from beautiful Portland, Oregon, with my friends and your hosts, authors Maxine Marcellini and Jeannie St. John Taylor. Every Monday, Maxine and Jeannie get together to share what's on their hearts with listeners around the world. They chat with other authors and friends on a wide variety of topics. Some bring a laugh, some cause us to wipe away a tear, but all of them send rivers of blessing into our lives. These shows can be life-changing if our hearts are open and allow the river of God's love to pour into our deepest needs. So, listeners, are you ready? Now's the perfect time for me to stop talking and let the ladies take us on today's exciting journey down the river.
And it's Monday, and we do have an exciting journey down the river to talk about today. And Tom is right. We are having a beautiful day in Portland, Oregon. The sun is shining bright. The frost has melted off the rooftops, and it's looking like a good day out there. How about you, Jeannie?
You know, I'm having a great day. We went out this morning, and have you noticed that the fog, I don't know if it's frozen fog or frost or what it is, but it hasn't gone away for like 3 days, and it just looks like snow. It's kind of surprising. I've never seen it like that before.
Over here, it's kind of gone away, but I hear that our wind weather is coming from the east side heading your way, so I think we just got
you.
The melted stuff first. But
It's
maybe going to get your way, but your place is down a little bit more into the shadows of the trees, and I think under the shadows of the trees, there's more of that frost hangs around a little bit longer.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love it.
Oh, it's been fabulous to see the white branches all just lined out with this frost in the morning.
I took
a cold, cold walk this morning. And just got to admire the scenery and try not to slip and slide at the same time in our 23-degree temperature fur.
We're not used to that, for people who don't know. We're in the balmy Northwest.
We're typically not below 32, but we are.
No,
right now.
Not even down to 32 very often.
No, not often.
Yeah.
So let's begin to talk about our guest for today. We're going to... he's just come on to the switchboard, and I'm going to introduce Richard Turnbull to you. He is the principal of Wycliffe Hall and a member of the Faculty of Theology at the University of Oxford. He left a career with Ernst & Young to study theology and train for the ministry at Durham and Oxford. He served as curate of Highfield, Southampton, before becoming vicar of Christ Church, Basingstoke. He has also served on the General Synod and as a member of the Archbishop's Council. We're going to be talking about his amazing, exciting book called Reviving the Heart, which is about the English revival of the 18th century. This exciting time introduces us to some of the main characters of that day, the Wesleys, George Whitefield, John Newton, and William Wilberforce. Many of you may have seen the movie Amazing Grace, when it aired, and two of these men actually were a big part of that movie and part of that movement that took place back in the revival of the 18th century. So out of that came something all of you are familiar with today, and that is the successful campaign to the end of slavery. So why don't we just go ahead and welcome our guest today, Richard Turnbull. Hi, Richard.
Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, this is Maxine, and Jeannie's on the line with us as well.
I'm here. So good to hear you.
We're so happy you made your way to the switchboard. Thank you. You never know when it's across England, all the way across that ocean, if we're going to connect well.
I was helped by my daughter.
Good.
How old's your daughter?
My daughter is 16. And
she knows
how to use Skype in a way that I don't.
She knows.
Thank you. We are so glad you had that kind of help. So why don't you give us a little bit of introduction into the origins of the evangelical revival that took place here.
Sure. Let me do that, and I hope your listeners will get inspired and excited by it. The revival happened in the the middle part of the 18th century. So that kind of 1730 through to till about 1800. And it happened on both sides of the Atlantic, in North America and in England and Wales as well, and some other places. And it was characterized by a number of individuals finding their hearts really transformed. And this happened independently of each other in the 1730s. A number of individuals finding their hearts spiritually changed, spiritually transformed. And it was from that that the revival sort of took off and broke out. And I suppose the reasons behind it were, first of all, that religion at the time was pretty dry, pretty formal. And what the great leaders and characters of the revival brought was a revitalization of faith, a commitment, a deep commitment to seeking God, a personal relationship with God. And through that, quite extraordinary and amazing individuals did amazing things. And as you said in your introduction, ultimately, that even led to the campaign against slavery, and then after that, the campaign against children working in factories and mines and so on. Mm-hmm. So quite amazing stuff.
So what would your definition be of a revival, Richard? What's the simplest way to understand a revival for our listeners?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think what most people say is that a revival is when a relatively large number of people come under the influence of spiritual formation in a relatively confined area over a relatively short period of time. So it's a lot of people finding their hearts change in a relatively small area in a relatively short period of time. A direct example of that in North America was when revival broke out in Massachusetts, in Northampton County, Massachusetts, the late 1720s, under Jonathan Edwards. And then in England, we found revival breaking out in Wales, and then in certain towns and villages and areas like Yorkshire in the north of England, Cornwall in the southwest of England. And so it's when people have this common and shared experience of spiritual transformation.
You know, what is it that you think accounts for the fact that all the revivals happened almost simultaneously and it was so widespread?
Yeah, yeah. There are, of course, some things you can't answer. So
yes,
there are some things you can't actually say we know precisely why that happened. But one thing that we do know is that those involved in revival corresponded with each other. And so, for example, when revival broke out in Massachusetts, the story of that revival was transmitted to England by a man called Isaac Watts, who was a great hymn writer. And he introduced the story of the Jonathan Edwards revival into England. And that meant that stories began to circulate. And you've got to remember, this was a time when the writing of letters and the writing of correspondence was just beginning to get a little bit easier. And there were these channels of communication, both into Europe and across the Atlantic. And you know, John Wesley and George Whitfield constantly went back and forth from England to the American colonies, as they then were. And so the stories of revival went both ways. Germany was involved as well, because it was in Germany that there was a group of Christians known as the Moravians, who had particularly given emphasis to this idea of a personal relationship with God. And when John Wesley sailed from England to Georgia in 1735, on the ship that was sailing across the Atlantic, he met a group of these Christians from Moravia. And that was the first time that John Wesley really was able to understand and grasp that it was possible to have a relationship with God. But you can see through that how the stories of the revival went back and forth across the Atlantic and throughout Europe.
That's exciting. You know, when you think about the age we live in, we push buttons and information flies around. But it wasn't that easy back then, but the stories still moved around in powerful ways and touched the lives of many, many people on both continents.
Exactly. You know, it was transmitted through people meeting, it was transmitted through letters, and it was transmitted through the publication of sermons, the publication of books and or pamphlets, and so on and so forth. And so really it became quite an exciting and dynamic period as all of these individuals began to correspond with each other and stories began to circulate.
Was there a great deal of oppression going on from the church at that point in time?
Well, again, I think that's a really insightful question, because I think one of the characteristics of the revival was that the greatest opposition came not from outside the church, but from within the church. And George Whitefield found himself being excluded from the pulpits and the churches, both in England and in North America, actually. In North America, he suffered because he described a Presbyterian minister, Gilbert Tennant, as a faithful minister of Jesus Christ. And those from his own denomination, the Church of England, the established church, couldn't bear to hear that, and so wouldn't let him preach. And in England, he was threatened with imprisonment, with prosecution in the law courts because of his preaching. And you know, it's because of that that both Whitefield and Wesley began to preach in the open air. And some of the most exciting stories of the revival come from these examples of preaching in the open air, which they only did because the church was oppressing them and trying to force them out. And perhaps the examples I can just give you of that, certainly in England, which I know best, crowds just outside the city of Bristol. Bristol is about 80 miles to the west of London, which in England is quite a long way. I realize that's not very far in North America. But 80 miles to the west of London, the churches were closed to Whitefield, and so he began to preach to the poor miners, the colliers, who are among the poorest of the poor. And when he first did it, 200 people came to listen. Within 4 weeks, he was preaching to 10,000.
Wow.
And
some of your listeners may know of Charles Wesley's famous hymn, "Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing." And Wesley wrote that specifically for these big gatherings of the miners near Bristol. And both Whitefield and Wesley were preaching there to crowds of tens of thousands. And then in London, there were some crowds of 20 or 30 thousand people coming to listen to this preaching and this proclamation. You almost wonder how they managed to do it, because today we're so used to microphones, we're so used to ways of having our voices amplified. But they would stand on a hill, and Whitefield would set up a little pulpit, and they were just great orators, and they would preach for an hour and a half, perhaps 2 hours, but probably not more. And people were just transformed and transfixed.
It shows how hungry people are, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, Whitefield preached to the heart. Well, they both did, both of these early leaders. They preached to the heart. People knew in this day, in this age, in the 18th century, the 1730s, 1740s, they knew in their heads the truths about God. But what they didn't know was God in their heart. And what both Whitefield and Wesley did was they preached to the heart. And that was what changed the whole scenario. So it wasn't just head knowledge. It was a heart being changed and transformed.
You know, you talked when we first started about how you would really like to set people on fire and get this started. And I know that's what I find myself praying as you speak, you know, and I'm thinking, Lord, we just need this in our country. What are some of the practical suggestions? I'm thinking of things like John Wesley's Grace Rating Diary. Do you have things like that? I love that.
Yeah. I think I think there are a number of interesting lessons we can learn. And the first of those was these were men and women, men and women of prayer. And Wesley would rise to pray at 5 a.m. William Grimshaw, one of the great, less well-known pioneers of the revival in Yorkshire, he would rise to pray at 5 a.m. And they would be praying for this change of the heart. Then at the same time, they would recognize that they needed to experience that in their own lives. And that's where John Wesley's grace rating comes from. I mean, you might think it's slightly strange, but what he did was he wrote down and recorded in his journal how he was getting on with God. And maybe that's a lesson for us, that we should maybe be a bit more proactive, a bit more specific in our own spiritual lives. And maybe we should try it out, writing down how we're getting on with God, praying for revival, and all of the time it was linked to the preaching of the word. It was never separated from the preaching of the scriptures. So you couldn't just say this was emotionalism or anything like that. It was those three things: faithfulness to the scriptures, prayer, and something about reflecting on one's own spiritual life and journey. And I think we can probably learn from all those things today. They never shied away from preaching the new birth. That's what was at the time so divisive, preaching that we needed to be born again, you know, to receive new birth. And I wonder whether we shy away a bit from that today because we're a bit, we worry whether we might cause offense. We wish to be inclusive and all of those things. And I'm not suggesting we should be arrogant or rude in any way, but maybe we should recapture some of that courage, that led them to give everything for the gospel. A lot of them died young. William Grimshaw, the man from up in Yorkshire who travelled hundreds of miles to preach the gospel, one of his last words was, "Oh, that we may spend and be spent in proclaiming the glorious gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ." What amazing words to end your life with.
So
I think we can recapture.
Right.
We can recapture some of that energy and some of that. I mean, the reason I wrote the book, I think, was to inspire people with the story. Not to tell them what to do, but to inspire people that this is what can happen and this is how God can use people.
Just listening to you, it is inspiring to just listen to you, Richard.
It is.
You are really, I'm caught up in what you're saying because I love knowing there were men and women out there who stood up for their faith, who weren't afraid to speak out, and who actually did this irrespective of whether their life was threatened by what they did or not.
Exactly. I mean, another example, just to keep some stories going, a man called, again, not a well-known name, a man called William Remain, and he became one of the first evangelicals to gain a church in the city of London. And he was locked out of this church so that he couldn't preach. He was elected as an assistant minister, and he had the right to preach in the afternoon, but the rest of the church staff wouldn't open the church, they wouldn't heat it, and they wouldn't light it, and he carried on anyway. There were queues of people going down Fleet Street in London, where this church, St. Dunstan's, was located. And it's one of the great streets in London, even to this day, Fleet Street. And eventually there was legal action that forced the church authorities to open the doors to enable him to go inside and to preach his sermons and to teach. But he never gave up. John Newton is another example. You mentioned John Newton in your introduction.
Yes.
You know, here was a man who was refused ordination by the Church of England. I think it was three times he was refused ordination. Eventually was ordained. He wrote hymns like Amazing Grace, you know, what a marvellous hymn. And then it was in his congregation that William Wilberforce was present and heard John Newton preaching. So you can see how they begin to link together.
Yeah, it's powerful. Richard, how would people get a hold of you? How would they find your book? Would you give us some website or some information on how this is possible? Because I think this is a book so many people ought to grab onto and read.
Well, it's available on Amazon. So it's on Amazon.com. So it's on the North American International Amazon site. It's available from there. If people can't get it, they could email me. My email is rdturnbull@aol.com. That's nice and straightforward. But Amazon is probably the easiest place. I think Barnes & Noble have it. I know they're a U.S. Firm. I'm not sure whether they extend into Canada and so on.
Okay. I would assume so.
Can you
bring out what this revival did to the local environment, the national environment, and the global environment? I mean, beyond just the slavery thing being impacted, what else happened?
Well, I think a number of things happened. What happened locally was that towns and villages and communities were changed and transformed forever. There's an example, various examples of literally hundreds of people coming under the influence of the gospel, and then they would begin meeting together to pray and to read the scriptures and to do good works, to do social work, social and community work as well, was one of the things that flowed out from this revival. And so, again, moving into the sort of the more regional scene, you had politics being affected, both through the anti-slavery movement, but also after that, through people in England like the Earl of Shaftesbury, again, not so well known as William Wilberforce, but a man who served in Parliament for 60 years and was responsible for ending the practice of children of as young as 4 years old, being forced up chimneys, working in mines and working in factories and suffering injuries and distress and so on and so forth. And he was converted and he gave his life work to bringing about real change at that national level. Internationally, of course, what it really did was open up massive channels of communication between the English-speaking worlds. So the English-speaking worlds of North America, the British Isles, to some extent of continental Europe, although not quite so straightforward in continental Europe, with the exchange of people, the impact, of course, in the United States or in America through the movement against slavery there in the years to come, a little bit later, obviously, from the immediate years of the 18th century. So this movement was absolutely transformational at every level. I mean, some of the great hymn writers, John Newton, Isaac Watts, Charles Wesley, these hymns were all written at this time, and we sing them in our churches today with gusto. But they were written in the midst of this melting pot of revival. And so we should remember that when we sing these songs and hymns out in our churches.
You know, one of the things that this makes me think of is just from the dates that you've mentioned. I mean, our country was established in the 1700s, and we're in the middle of this period, 1776, with the United States.
Exactly.
And so we're in the midst of revival while our country was being established. And somewhere along the line, we've forgotten those roots.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, Wesley and Whitfield, their first contacts across the Atlantic were with what were then the American colonies, South Carolina and Georgia. But as you said, within half a century, the United States had been formed as an independent country. We'd had the independence from the UK, and that was all going on right in the middle of all of these activities. And of course, the American Constitution guarantees religious independence, and so on and so forth. That sort of
you know,
that link, freedom, you know.
One thing I wanted you to talk about, too, was how was the social classes, the involvement, like everything from the countess to people who weren't quite as well known. How does that differ than maybe religion had been in your country before that or anywhere?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one of the challenges, England has tended to be quite socially divided in that sense. So it tended to be a little rigid in its sort of class structure. Faith had not really reached very easily the more what we might call the working classes, the workers, the people who worked the land and worked in the mines. And one of the things that really came out from the revival was that it reached the ordinary people. Of course, that's one reason why the church establishment was so irritated and was so opposed, because the church structures were being bypassed and people were meeting together with Bibles in their hands, able to see it for themselves. And yet at the same time, you had people like this amazing woman, the Countess of Huntingdon. Again, many of your listeners may never have heard of her, but the most amazing woman who actually introduced the gospel by inviting her aristocratic friends into her living room, into her home, and inviting converted clergy to come and preach the gospel. And then in the late 1770s, around about 1779, the Countess was able to build a large chapel in London, which sat 5,000 people. People of all types and of all social backgrounds were able to come to hear the gospel. And again, that's been a challenge in England about this, trying to, the gospel unifies. The faith is meant to bring people together, not to divide through social background and so on. And then into the 19th century, going back to the Earl of Shaftesbury, he and a group of clergy introduced religious worship services in theatres in London. So around about 1860, a little bit further on from where we are, there was 20,000 people a week meeting for worship across five London theatres, led by this English aristocrat and a group of clergymen who were converted. So you do see this great effort to reach everybody, every level of society, the politicians and the opinion formers, but also the ordinary people in the street, as it were. And that's what's so great about it, isn't it? It was everybody was being brought together. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just aimed at one group and not another. It's a great story.
It definitely sounds a whole lot like what's going on in the Book of Acts. People heard, they liked what they heard, they found Christ, and their lives were changed forever. And then they started meeting together and hearing the scriptures and searching out truth and moving into a stronger relationship with Christ on a personal level. It was no more of the religiosity of the day. So, Richard, we are definitely running out of time. Is there one more thing you'd like to leave our listeners with before we have to say goodbye today?
Well, I think what I'd say is use the examples of history to be inspired for today. So use these examples of Whitfield, of Wesley, of John Newton, of William Wilberforce, of the Earl of Shaftesbury from the next century, to be inspired that God, through changing our hearts, can change the world through us. And let's have a big vision and a big picture. And let's seek God personally in our hearts and ask him to change us and to use us in these similar sort of amazing ways.
Well, thank you, Richard. That's an excellent message to leave our listeners with today, and I pray that every one of them is going to take this to heart and realize that they can be a change maker too. They can make a difference right where they are with the people that God has put around them. So God bless you, and we appreciate this show so much today. The archives will
be up.
Thank
you very much. Thank you very much indeed. God bless you.
This is Tom Fuller saying thank you for joining us on The River today. I pray blessings have come your way. Please check out our hosts' websites to learn a little more about them. Maxine Marcellini is the author of Rebuilding Families $1 at a Time, Blended Families, and Raising Children in Blended Families. She's a life coach whose website, rebuildingfamilies.net, is full of family helps and resources. Jeannie St. John Taylor is the author and illustrator of more than 25 books for adults as well as children. You'll find her books, plus a link to read her newest biblical fiction, City of a Thousand Gods, on her website at jeanniestjohntaylor.com. All our programs are archived for later listening enjoyment. Consider posting a comment after today's show. And please let your friends know about what's happening at the river. Most of all, remember, you are never alone in this river called life. Jesus is with you and only a prayer away.